Hello, Josh.
Hey, Glenn, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. I'm getting blogged out here, though. This is my second Blogging Heads appearance of the week.
Of the
And
week? Good Lord.
yeah, I think I'm going to have to talk to Bob Wright about getting cut in on some of the compensation.
Yeah, no, you're getting, you know, I understand.
My share of zero will be
Yeah,
zero, but I still feel better about getting my
yeah,
share.
nobody is paid more than you for contributing
Exactly.
to
This is
Blogging
unlike
Heads.
the
And,
economics department
yeah,
I work in, but we won't go there.
right. No, it's been a while since we've talked, and first I thought we could start off with all the good news, but then I thought since there isn't any good news since the last time we talked, maybe we could jump right. There's lots to talk about, though.
Well,
None of
indeed
it
there is.
good.
I mean, we live in interesting times. I think we can agree to that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'd like a day to go by that was a little calmer. You know, and you know, it's also interesting times, but times that those of us who were not brought up in the church or in a temple or in any kind of religious community, we have a little bit of trouble relating to because of the nature of the focus and the discourse.
Yeah, I hear that complaint. People saying, why are we talking about this? And there's a very obvious degree of self-awareness, it seems to me, in the press and in the media about, the responsibility that people who frame public discussion have to not dwell on trivia, to kind of police themselves and so on. And I've been hearing people say, well, we'll get past this, news cycle, two-day story, three-day story.
Yeah.
How long will we be talking about Jeremiah Wright and so forth and so on? And now beginning to say, because of the things that have happened, and in particular Barack Obama's sort of severing his connections very publicly, that it's time to move on, it's time to move on. But I don't know. That sounds convenient for the Obama campaign, but I don't know if that's really what journalism should do. I think there are many unanswered questions that remain to be explored here. I'm not talking about finding dirt. I'm talking about examining the character of our public discourse and the nature of how we deal with issues of race and questions of identity and authenticity and all these kinds of things.
Well, what did you
I
think of
think.
Jeremiah Wright's performances at the National Press Club?
Well,
And
I want to warn people that if they have children listening, they may want to, take them to another room because I'm going to say some things on behalf of Jeremiah Wright, and actually, I'm going to say some positive things about Louis Faircon before this is over. So I just want you to be warned. What did I think?
I close my doors.
I based this on observing his speech at the NAACP meeting in Detroit on Sunday and observing his appearance at the National Press Club on Monday. After the Sunday night speech, I thought a number of things. I thought, well, this fellow is obviously very angry. And a prime question in my mind became, what is motivating him? What's really going on here? And I think that backstory is fascinating. It's a story that I hope will one day be told in an objective way, just for the sake of some understanding of our culture and political history, because I think it's very interesting. But it was very clear to me that Jeremiah Wright was possessed by a certain animus, a certain distaste for the way that the way the narrative, the way the national dialogue and discussion had
Let me
developed.
offer speculation about this. Of course, I don't know the guy at all, but there was, I pay a lot of attention to what Chris Rock says, and Chris Rock made a joke that Reverend Wright responded to. Chris Rock said something about Reverend Wright being an, angry 75-year-old black man. He said, well, every 75-year-old black man is angry. And Reverend Wright's response was, hey, typical media, I'm not 75 years old. But what it reminded me of, what Wright's focusing on the age issue reminded me of, was one of the things that Obama had said in his Philadelphia speech, where, and this was something that Mike Dawson wrote a piece about that I thought was very good, where part of Obama's story about race in America had to do, I'm sure you remember this, with the particular experience of black men growing up in the 1950s and having this experience of American racial apartheid and having a sense of anger and seeing the world moving on, but retaining that sense of anger. And I thought if I were Jeremiah Wright, I, as I said, don't know the guy. If I were Jeremiah Wright, and I heard that line of that narrative about the sources of my anger, that I was basically, as Chris Rock said, you know, an old black guy, and that's why I was, I would have been a little bit pissed off about that. And the point that Mike Dawson made, which I thought was extremely helpful and astute, was that when you look at the differences between, you know, black public opinion and white public opinion on issues about domestic social policy or the nature of race in America or foreign policy issues, and you see a very deep divide, racial divide, doesn't track age at all.
Yeah, hold on, Josh. I hear you, but I want to try to finish laying out what I was starting out with. Let me just take note of your point about age.
Yeah.
I said I thought several things, and one of them was that Jeremiah Wright was obviously being animated by some strong feelings, and it's an important question as to what they are. You conjecture that they may have been to a certain degree being insulted or put off by this formulation of Barack Obama's. I must tell you, I too was put off by that particular formulation.
I imagine.
And wrote in a blog somewhere, you know, I'm a man of approximately Jeremiah Wright's generation, not exactly, but approximately. I'm not 75, but neither is Jeremiah Wright. Yeah. I think he's more like 65, but in any case, I would have found it a little bit patronizing to be told by this fellow that, I just don't understand America. I'm shaped by a certain bitterness and disappointment that has caused me to see the world in these distorted ways. But I just want to make another couple of points,
sure,
and I can do it very quickly. So one of them is the animus that was driving Jeremiah Wright. Another one was the very particular formulation that he laid down, which I don't think should be lost in all of this, which is that different is not deficient.
Yes.
I think that's a fair argument. I mean, I think what he's saying is, my church tradition, my political tradition, the community that I come out of, the South Side of Chicago, warts and all, is different. African-American people's experience in this country is different. The narrative that we've constructed to understand our history is different. The attitude that we have, the posture that we take, and I don't mean to speak for black people here or to imply that we are monolithic, but nevertheless, the kind of thrust of it is more critical, more distant from, more dissonant with the kind of mainstream narrative, the kind of self-congratulatory,
right,
city on a hill, yeah, banner of freedom waving above our armies, arrogate to ourselves the right to dictate and decide events in the world on behalf of what we regard as the ideals of civilization and so on and so forth. Different, not deficient. So another point, the second point that I want to make, besides the what is animating Jeremiah Wright question, is, well, he is making a claim that I think warrants to be considered seriously, which is that the fact that the resonant, the sounds, the smells, the body language, the rhythms of African-American public and political life as manifest on the South Side of Chicago is different doesn't make them deficient, un-American, or unpatriotic. And then I thought there was a third point, and the third point was about black liberation theology. I mean, there is a very specific point to be made here. He said he's defending the black church. Most of the talking heads have said he's really about himself. It's all an egomania thing and so forth and so on. And I think that's really very superficial and short-sighted. Mm-hmm. And this is no brief for as such for Jeremiah Wright. It's just the observation that the tradition, the theological tradition amongst activist African-American clergy that you can associate with this theology of black liberation is a dignified, historically coherent, well intellectually elaborated. I'm not saying it's infallible or even saying that it's right or subscribe to it,
yeah,
but it is in fact a doctrine, a theory, a hermeneutic, a lens of interpretation, a way of looking at events in the world, the spiritual lens, that has some authenticity within the context of African-American history. And to have it simply lumped in, oh, this is some left-wing crazy,
yeah,
wackadoodle, nutcase, extremist, racist ideology is extremely insulting. And this is something that I think Jeremiah Wright was trying to rectify.
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, now finally I want to say,
yeah,
and I'll be done.
Yeah.
He did go over the top.
Yes.
He did,
yeah,
show his butt, is,
yeah,
the way we would have said it back in the community,
yeah,
that I was growing up. And he seemed to be taking some relish in doing it.
Yes.
And that is, of course, deeply disturbing,
right,
to the Obama campaign,
yeah,
and a fascinating political fact that I think we might well try to analyze. But that's,
yeah,
what I thought about the speech.
Yeah. you know, I've read the National Press Club speech a couple of times, but the transcript both of the speech and of the discussion afterwards. I thought the speech was very good, and the speech had all of the points that you made, including the discussion, you know, I learned quite a bit about black liberation theology. He talked about the aspects of three points. It was a very good statement about liberation, transformation, and reconciliation.
That's it.
Wonderful, laid it out, talked about the historical issues, and made some very good points along the way about his role over the course of his life as, if I can put it this way, as a public servant. I mean, he served the country, unlike the clowns who are running the country now.
Fair point.
Very fair point. And he served the community. You know, he built a wonderful congregation and has served people who were poor and people with AIDS. All of this is extremely, all that's important, extremely important. And I thought it was, you know, dignified and serious and insightful. And this was obviously a person of, you know, considerable intellectual and moral power. The discussion, all of the points that have come up about the speech came up in the course of the
Q&A.
In the course of the Q&A.
Yeah.
And that's where the animus and the anger came out. You know, when I listened to the speech, I thought, good, you know, it's great that Barack Obama was sitting for 15 years in a church where this is what the pastor was saying, was this kind of stuff. Because that distinguishes his, Obama's, experience, you know, Sunday morning, the most segregated. Well, he went to a place, where he was hearing stuff that's probably not that different from what lots of people in the rest of the world think about the United States. A mixture of admiration for the country, the guy served the country, its people and the military, but also a sharply critical perspective on it. I think it's important to be for Obama to have been hearing that, and I think the message about different is not deficient. Terrific. The problem was in the Q&A, and what I thought in the Q&A was showing his butt. This was somebody who showed in response to questions, first of all, no humility. Maybe that's because he was angry. Whatever the explanation is, I had the sense of somebody who's got no humility, who is not being respectful of the wider audience that he's talking to on this occasion, and respectful in the sense of hearing things the way they might hear them and trying to make sure that people understand. And most important, and this is really what underlies the previous two things, this was somebody who let his anger get in the way of a sense of his appreciation of the importance of the moment. This was really a morally important moment for the Obama campaign, for Jeremiah Wright, and I think for the country. And I could imagine Obama's disappointment. Here's this guy who he looks up to. He says his story is becomes a Christian after he hears Jeremiah Wright talk in a sermon about the audacity of hope. Marries him and Michelle Obama, baptizes the kids. And then at a time when it's a serious moment and when you hope that somebody that you look up to and admire is going to transcend himself, what he does is he sinks into it and says a bunch of stuff that he didn't have to say, I thought it was a sad and disappointing performance by somebody who's a serious guy. Yeah,
Josh, yeah. This is precisely the thing to be understood here. Why did he feel no loyalty to the enterprise, which is the Obama candidacy?
Mm-hmm.
Why did he feel no loyalty? Now everyone is assuming that that's his failing. In other words, that any sensible person would have felt loyal in that way, that it must be because of egomania or jealousy or, a nursing feeling of injury because he was treated badly or something, that he's lashed out. It couldn't possibly be that he's evaluated the situation mm-hmm. from his perspective and come to the conclusion that the candidacy isn't due his loyalty, and therefore he's justified.
Wasn't about the candidacy. It wasn't the loyalty to the candidacy. It was he accused Obama of lying, and that's disrespectful to the person.
What he said was he reported. I didn't hear it, Josh. As
he said, he said that Obama spoke as a politician, and that he in effect didn't believe what he was saying. That is accusing him of lying. And what Obama was most angry about yesterday, I thought that anger was appropriate. That's not about loyalty to a candidacy. That's about disrespect for a person.
Okay, Josh, you nor I were there when Jeremiah Wright prayed with Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and their children, the prayers that they pray in their prayer closet, prior to him going up in Springfield, Illinois, to announce in January of 2007 that he was running for president. We weren't there. What Jeremiah Wright said was, when I prayed with him privately, I was his pastor and we prayed together. When he became a politician and went up publicly, Dick Durbin introduced him.
Right.
Okay. Now, is that accusing somebody of lying to say that?
That's not the comment I'm talking about. I'm talking about Jeremiah Wright's response to the questions in the Q&A about Obama distancing himself. And he said,
what he said. He said, I'm a pastor and he's a politician. He behaved as a politician behaves.
What does that mean that he behaved as a politician behaved? He said he said he didn't distance himself from me. He just said what he had to say. And
that's what he's saying.
Right. But said what he's had to say as opposed to saying what he really believes. And I thought Obama was saying what he really believes. And if he thinks, I don't think there's any hair splitting on this one. He was saying Obama got up and acted like a politician and distorted what he really thinks about me and what he really thinks about these issues in order to score political points.
That is what he was saying.
Yeah. And that, I think, is not an insult to the candidacy. It's not a disrespect for the candidacy. It was the hardest thing for Obama to say in the press conference yesterday, which was that he was really angry because this guy who he's had a long-term relationship had shown disrespect for him. He had insulted him. He had insulted his integrity, and he had insulted his honor.
Or he had told on him. The alternative interpretation is that he had said something publicly that a friend would never have said publicly, but that was nevertheless true. In other words, who's in a better position to know what Barack Obama really thinks? I mean, I actually think this point is very important.
Yeah. No,
and I don't want to be misunderstood. This is not McCarthyism here. I categorically deny and reject any such accusation. I am not trying to, derogate or to, slime somebody with a label. I'm just saying, Barack Obama's candidacy, it seems to me, has always been a front room, we can see everything, back room, we don't quite know what's going on candidacy.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, it seems to me, been, we're taking the high road and we're going to talk about this set of issues. Transformation, no more politics as usual, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But in the back room, there has always been, I believe, the confidence amongst many people who back the candidacy, especially progressives, that in fact, what he would believe, what he would do, how he'd actually act,
mm-hmm.
Is not quite being articulated in the campaign,
mm-hmm.
Because it's, it would be too controversial, too divisive, and so forth mm-hmm. and so on. But we can rely that the right thing will be done.
Yeah.
Certainly African Americans have been tacitly fed this line, have been said, but of course Barack can't talk too much about affirmative action. Of course Barack is not going to come out and denounce the judge's acquittal of the New York City police officers in the Bell killing or any such thing. He's not going to be Jesse Jackson. He's not going to, show up at the Tavis Smiley thing, whatever. He has to take a different role, but we can rely that he's our guy.
Yeah.
Now, if that, in fact, is part of the dynamic, and I believe it is, you can't even say the man's name. If I say Barack Hussein Obama, people will start accusing me of being something just because I uttered the name. There's always been this kind of non-transparent, this kind of symbolic dimension to the candidacy that it says it's more than what it actually states. So now, here we have the guy who he goes into the prayer closet mm-hmm. with. Okay? The guy who for 20 years, he's been involved in intimate conversation and ongoing intellectual and spiritual development with. And this guy comes out and makes a representation about what the candidate actually thinks. Now, as I said, one question is why he did it. But the fact that he did it hardly, in my mind, necessarily constitutes some moral breach, unless it is a breach of a tacit understanding that they had.
I wasn't saying that it was a moral breach. Yeah. What I was saying was, let's be precise about what he did.
Okay.
It was not an insult to the candidacy. It was an insult to the person. And maybe, so, look, sometimes an insult to the person is what's warranted. Barack Obama said about Jeremiah Wright that what you heard from him was just a bunch of rants. That was an I'd say that was an insult to the person. And I think it's, you know, unfortunate that, you know, you get into a situation like that. My point is that the push really came to shove, I think, when for Obama, this was, if you watched him, you watched what he said, you watched the body language, you watched the difficulty he had making this point. The thing that really riled him, I think, I don't know the guy, just I've watched his press conference several times now.
Yeah.
Seemed to me that the thing that really riled him was Jeremiah Wright saying, you got up in front of the country and you distanced yourself from me. And you did that not because you really feel that distance, but because you had to do that as a politician.
Okay,
so
Jack,
in that case, you threw me under the bus. And you can say that that insult was justified, but it wasn't about the campaign. It was about the person.
Well, okay, I take issue with you there, but I want to put some information on the table. Let me just quote one sentence from Barack Obama's Philadelphia speech, which I think is a critical sentence for Jeremiah Wright, and it certainly is a critical sentence for me, and it's this.
Mm-hmm.
But the remarks that have caused this recent firestorm expressed a profoundly distorted view of this country, a view that sees white racism as endemic and that elevates what is wrong with America above all that we know is right with America, a view that sees the conflicts in the Middle East as rooted primarily in the actions of stalwart allies like Israel, instead of emanating from the perverse and hateful ideologies of radical Islam. Close quote.
Yeah.
Now I ask you, is it implausible to think that Barack Obama does not in fact genuinely believe that the conflicts in the Middle East are rooted in the perverse and hateful, I quote, ideologies of radical Islam, rather than in the misguided policies of allies like the State of Israel? Is it possible that Jeremiah Wright knows that Barack Obama doesn't really believe that? I think it's entirely plausible that Jeremiah Wright knows, as a matter of fact, that Barack Obama doesn't believe that a perverse and hateful Muslim ideology is the root of the conflict in the Middle East. In fact, a lot of thinking people across this globe don't believe that. And one of the reasons why people like Andrew Sullivan think that Barack Obama's elevation to the presidency would open up a whole new era, and I believe you may agree with this too, of international relations for the United States, and would send such a hopeful message to kids sitting around in the slums of Jakarta and in Islamabad and Damascus, Syria, and other like places.
And one of the reasons that people believe that too.
Is because they think that, in fact, he does not hold the view that these epic and historic conflicts in the Middle East are rooted in perverse and hateful Muslim ideology. He rather holds a much more sophisticated and a much more balanced view of that question. There's plenty of historical evidence in Barack Obama's own record to suggest that he holds a more balanced view. So was he posturing? Is that line in that speech in Philadelphia there in order to placate potential political problems rather than to give a genuine expression of his view? I think it's entirely plausible that he might not have been entirely honest with the country about his views in that case. And I'd really like to know what you think about that.
Yeah. Let's divide the issue in there are three points here. Actually, there are four. First of all, I'm imagining that you share, at least to some extent, the view that you're attributing to me and to Andrew Sullivan.
I'm sorry, did I share what? I just didn't hear you.
That you share the view that you're attributing to Andrew Sullivan and to me, that one of the best things about the Obama candidacy is that it does promise to send a message to the rest of the world about the United States.
No, I don't actually share that view. I mean, send a message, maybe yes, but as long as, for example, we maintain a nuclear arsenal capable of incinerating all of humanity, and Barack Obama has essentially nothing to say about that. As long as we have a military budget that is greater than the combined military budgets of almost every other nation in the world, with a couple of exceptions, As long as we have a foreign policy that is, and I'm sorry that this is going to sound like a left-wing rant. I'm sorry. But here you go.
I agree with all of this.
It's imperial. It's a global imperial order that we're enforcing with hundreds of billions of dollars of military expenditure per year by force and the threat of force. And Barack Obama has nothing to say about that. Then why should I think that his elevation to the presidency is going to usher in a whole new order? Why should I think military contracting is going to be any difference? Why should I think that people
usher in a whole new? I didn't talk about ushering in a whole new order. I talk about sending a message, and it's a message that's different from. We have three candidates now, Glenn. We've got John McCain, who likes all of that stuff. We've got Hillary Clinton, and we can come back to this. We have Hillary Clinton, who has said that we will obliterate.
Yeah, we should come back to that. Yeah.
Iran.
Because Barack Obama didn't disagree with that. He has yet to disagree.
No, that's not true. He disagreed with the point about obliterating. He disagreed, I thought it's a weakness, and this gets closer to the point here. It's a weakness of his candidacy that he didn't come out swinging on the obliteration point, because that was an open threat. This was, this is Hillary Clinton's Curtis LeMay moment. You know, Curtis LeMay back during the Vietnam War says, let's bomb them back into the Stone Age. You know, the thing is, in the Stone Age, there were people living. When she talks about obliterating Iran,
she's threatening
a nuclear attack on a country that doesn't have nuclear weapons. So we have three candidates. I'm not talking about – let's keep the bar in one place. I'm not talking about Barack Obama bringing on the millennium, peace on earth and goodwill. But Barack Obama is not making threats to obliterate countries that don't have nuclear weapons because of speculations that if they get them and made an attack on a country that does have nuclear weapons.
Okay, Josh, I take the point.
That was just awful.
Yes.
I'm glad you take the point. I think it's an important one, and I think
the question here was whether or not Barack Obama's success in his campaign for the presidency was going to send an important signal to the world about the posture of the United States. And
I guess
we disagree with how important the signal would be. I won't discount that some signal would be sent and that there are differences amongst the candidates.
But I don't think it changes
the basic facts on the ground. We're hated around the world, as has been said more than once since September 11, 2001, because of what we do, as well as of who we are. And I haven't heard a whole lot of talk about what we're doing, and particularly with respect to the conflict in the Middle East. Josh, again, I want to come back to that because it seems to me that's really very important.
Yeah. Okay, let's cut. I think Obama has been. I don't think we disagree on the substance of this. I think Obama has been weak on that issue, and if you divide up that sentence that you read, which I agree with you, is a crucial sentence in that Philadelphia speech. I agree very much with the first part of the sentence. I think that the first part of the sentence is about Jeremiah Wright emphasizing what's wrong with the country and not emphasizing or registering the other track on which the country moves. That is, that there are a set of commitments, political commitments to stated by Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address about liberty and equality, and a set of halting efforts to try to live up to those commitments, some successes and lots of failures. I think Obama's point is that if you want to understand the country, you have to understand that it moves in both those registers. And I think his criticism of Jeremiah Wright on the understanding of the United States was about Wright's failure to acknowledge that other register of political values of freedom and equality that the country moves in. That's a real disagreement between them. And I don't dismiss the view that the so-called other register about the political values of freedom and equality, it has been too much of a sham, and that the country doesn't deserve to be you know, the respect that Obama thinks.
But I didn't understand what you just said. Are you saying that you think the country does or does not deserve to be celebrated on the positive side instead of criticized on the negative side?
I think it deserves to be both. And I think that what Obama was criticizing Wright for was moving just in the one register and not in both. And I'm saying that's a real disagreement between them.
Now, maybe what I want to say is, so what Obama is saying is that, you know, this is not an entirely original analysis. Other people have made this observation, but I'll just persist. What Obama is saying to America, very importantly, is I will not emphasize this negative thing. I will not throw it up in your face. You will not see me stomping around angry. You will not see me ambulance chasing every racial train wreck that happens in this country. I'm going to stay on the high road. I'm going to look for, as he says, what unites us as opposed to what divides us. And again, I'm going to say it. I'm not going to show up with the parents of Sean Bell or other such people and deploy my political capital on behalf of this kind of insurgent critique of the use of power in American cities, of the use of deadly force by assault. I'm not going to be there with John Conyers and Jesse Jackson and all these other people. I'm a different kind of political figure, is what he's saying. And that bargain, that offer to the country, I will be African-American. I'll get 90% of the African-American support as I carry my party to the presidency. But I will be more than that. It's in my DNA. I'm all of America. This kind of argument, you know, is a commodity, I want to say, in the political marketplace here. It's something that people definitely want to hear. And this is quite apart, I want to say, from the objective historical and sociological facts of the matter. That is to say, from how important racism continues to be, from whether or not our institutions are 100 miles away or a half mile away from completing the historic mission of extending freedom to everybody and so forth. This is about a posture. This is a commodity that's being offered. This is a brand that has to be protected. And it may just be that Jeremiah Wright doesn't feel any loyalty to the protection and the projection of that particular brand.
Why reduce it by calling it a brand and a commodity?
Because the candidacy is based on a
person.
It's
not a brand and a commodity. It's a disagreement.
This is not a grassroots movement. This is not something that has a complex ideological root. This is a more or less spontaneous popular movement that's built around a set of ideas. So, of course, I want to talk about the brand because the brand is everything here. Okay,
but it's not a commodity.
Fine.
It's a project. It's a political project.
I would draw the word commodity if you prefer. I'll reject it and denounce it, as it were, because that's not really the point. The point is that it doesn't have to be authentic. That's the point. Yeah. It's manufactured. Suppose you're sitting on the south side of Chicago and you've got a 10,000-member congregation. Suppose you spend a quarter century trying to support, nurture, and comfort, build up, and develop people and institutions to try to withstand the storm, which is being on the south side of Chicago in the mid and late 20th century in the United States of America. Suppose that's what you spent your life's works doing, okay? Mm-hmm. You're black, and you understand that blackness in a sense of identity, of national, you know, self-understanding, of historical narrative, of purpose, of meaning. It's the lens through which you view the world and you interpret it. Now, somebody comes along who takes a coat out of your closet and puts it on. He becomes black and from the south side of Chicago. He becomes one of you. All right. Now he decides to run for high office. And those authentic aspects of your communal development, the sensibility that drives you every day, what you see coming up out of the lives of the people who are in your parish and who are strewn across that vast megalopolis, gets denied, distorted, turned into something else, discounted, diminished, marginalized, right? That could make you angry. You might feel that you have an obligation to speak out against that. You may feel that protecting the boundaries of the definition of your people and the integrity of its historical development is more important than the ambitions of any politician, whatever the color of that person may be.
I agree. That's an honest disagreement. This is a fundamental, important disagreement about the nature of the country and about a possible political project. It's an issue about how important is the double consciousness of being a member of that community and of being an equal citizen in the wider American polity. That's an old, that's an important issue. It's an honest disagreement.
Yep.
And I would like to have seen on both sides, but certainly on right side, and this is where I thought there was a difference between the speech and what he said in response to the questions. I would have liked to see an honest statement of that disagreement about the balance between those two, that within that double consciousness. I think that's the term that
that's Du Bois's
originates
term,
with
but
Du Bois.
I hear you. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And what I thought, so here is Wright, who gives what I again thought was a very good speech, extremely instructive, exactly the kind of thing that you want somebody to say: liberation, transformation, and reconciliation.
Right.
And reconciliation, you know, extremely important. And when he's asked the question, I mean, there were some great moments, even in the discussion, when somebody asked him about Muslims, and he quoted from Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, in response, I thought it was a really, you know, a great moment in the thing. But to have an honest discussion about the relationship between that black nationalist project, and I say that with complete respect. That's not a term of criticism.
No, that's exactly
a term
it.
Of respect.
Yeah.
Between that black nationalist project and that other project that Obama has tried to identify himself with, and you know, all along through it, and says it's in his DNA, he says it's in his upbringing, he's, you know, he comes from this complicated background, that's the narrative that he's told about himself. And I think we could have an honest, open disagreement about that. And I, what I thought was that, you know, that in Wright's responses to the questions, he lost that high ground. And that's where I thought that instead of using that as a moment, a kind of teaching moment for the country, and a you know, a pastoral moment and a moment of self-transcendence, I thought he sunk back into something. He didn't come up to what I thought. I didn't think he came up to what he's capable of. And that's why when Obama said he was disappointed, I understood what he meant.
I think a lot of people are going to agree with you, Josh, that the Christian thing to have done would have been to sucked it up, to have seen and felt whatever he saw and felt about what was happening, and what was happening to his own brand, and by that I mean, you know, to the reputation of his life's work, because Jeremiah Wright was, and I guess Gavin now is, going down in the history books as, you know, a wackadoodle, a nutcase, an extremist, a rapist, a fellow traveler with Farrakhan, someone outside the legitimate boundaries of American public discourse, somebody to be, you know, Father Coughlin, you know, David Duke, this kind of thing. Right,
and it's terrible.
He could see that happen to him. And the Christian thing,
I agree
people,
with you.
Yeah, I think it is horrible actually that this should
happen
to him.
Horrible.
It's a tragic thing that this would happen.
It is tragic.
And he would see this happening, and maybe the Christian thing to do would have been to sit back and just be patient and just wait. And then after January 20th, 2009, he could have written all the books, given all the interviews. There would have still been an audience for him, and so forth and so on. But what he said when he was asked this directly was, in my community, when you talk about my mama, I get up in your face. I'm not going to let you talk about my mama. And I take that at its at face value. I take it that he's saying that the way that it was being spun out, the way that the whole dynamic of the Reverend Wright albatross around the neck of our lovely candidate was developing, was discrediting and undignified and disrespectful of something that he cherished and regarded as very precious. And so he felt that it was necessary to speak out on behalf of it. And once he got going, I think you had to have been there in the room as well, because I got a call from a reporter yesterday who was there, you know, and he was saying that it's the press club and it was packed, of course, and that all the white reporters were up in the gallery, up in the balcony somewhere, and that the ground floor was filled with the likes of people like the former mayor, Marion Barry of Washington, D.C., the noted scholar and public intellectual Cornel West, and many others. In fact, this particular reporter, who happened to have been Jewish, told me that he had covered a black Muslim rally some years ago that was also at the press club or something like it. And many of the same characters who are figures in the Afro-nationalist intellectual political milieu around the District of Columbia were present for Jeremiah Wright on Monday at the press club, as they had been present on this previous occasion for this more explicitly black nationalist event. And the point of it all was that the dynamic in the room was he was preaching to the choir. He was slapping hands and, you know, giving high fives to people. He was pointing out people in the audience and saying, yeah, yeah, my brother, here I am, and so forth and so on. And it had that kind of revival meeting feel to it. And I guess the thing that I'm trying to say here is that those feelings, however they may look from San Francisco, and I don't mean that in any disrespect, those feelings look a lot different from the South Side of Chicago, where Louis Farrakhan has 10,000 followers. They, you know, those sentiments of standing up for our folk and not letting the kind of authentic voice of our people be diluted in this kind of charade of media circus of whatever mainstream media are doing looks a lot different from the ground in those communities.
And I'm at the risk of just saying the same thing. I thought you read the speech and you think, you know, he nailed it. And I thought he nailed it when he described black liberation theology. He nailed it when he said, I'm a friend of James Cone's and I learned a lot from him. But, you know, I go beyond him in my understanding of the roots of black liberation theology. Yeah. I thought he totally nailed it when he said, I serve the country, not the clowns who were criticizing me. He totally nailed it when he said, you know, I'm serving this community, people with AIDS, people who are sick, people who are in need, and I'm not wasting billions of dollars, you know, spending billions of dollars, wasting it on a war built on lies. I thought all of that was, you know, an important, powerful, and profound moral voice. And it also was, you know, it was not, you know, America is great. It was not the glorious tradition of the United States. It was about black liberation theology. So I thought he lost it later on. But on this point about preaching to the choir, I think it's, the stories that I read were that was that our friend Cornell was whistling from the audience. You know, but I thought that was what may have been what prompted him to say the stuff that I didn't think was particularly good, in just the way that I thought that we talk about San Francisco. I thought it was important that Obama's low point in this campaign, which was that set of comments in San Francisco about people clinging to religion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, religion and guns and, you know, hatred of people who look different and talk different. I don't think it was any accident that that set of comments was made in a room where probably everybody in the room shares that patronizing sensibility. That was not something that you could get up and say with a bunch of different people.
So consider this.
And I thought it was awful.
Consider this.
I thought that was awful.
Consider this. Here's the analogy I want to draw. Exactly. I agree with you about what you've just said, that San Francisco was bad for Obama precisely because the audience to which he was speaking was an audience that we could well imagine has its nose up in the air about these people and is ready to have them reduced to some mechanistic explanation of their behavior, which allows these people to still maintain their sense of superiority. Right. But you see, for some black Americans, I would guess, like the Cornel West, perhaps, and the Jeremiah Wrights, evidently, of this world, and I want to say perhaps to some extent for the Glenn Lowrys of this world, the deployment of race, the deft, artful, extremely skillful deployment of race, not too close, but just close enough, okay? Different. I mean, I left Harvard Law School and I went to work in this community. I could have gone to Wall Street. I went to work in this community. Look what kind of person I am. I'm sorry, I don't mean this to sound negative, but I'm just saying. It's a deployment in a certain way. Again, reliance on the solid block voting of the African-American electorate in constituency after constituency in order to establish one's electoral bona fides when those people are voting for you because you're the black candidate. And yet, the very definition of your candidacy is that you transcend blackness.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Now, for many people, Barack Obama's, many people of that persuasion, Barack Obama's deployment of race has the feel to them of the way that the bitter comments about religion and guns may have felt to somebody dwelling in a small town, except that the audience is not a room full of San Francisco liberal fat cats. The audience is, if you will, white America. Barack Obama is standing up and telling white America, black people are too angry. Barack Obama is standing up and telling white America, black people have pretty much gotten what they've got coming. No, those are not the words, but that's how the performance is being digested. And if you're sitting somewhere as a black theologian, radical, subversive, marginal figure who thinks America's historic role is deeply ambivalent, beginning with the extirpation of the native population of this continent and extending on to nuclear terrorism, which, you know, is a way of construing our international relations practice, at least in certain instances of it. If you had that view, you might feel deeply somehow betrayed, misrepresented. You may feel that this is an inauthentic deployment of race, and that might motivate you to want to destroy this person's candidacy. And that, by the way, is my answer to the first question that I started out with here. I think what's motivating Jeremiah Wright is very explicit. He doesn't want to see Barack Obama become president of the United States. He thinks that the fact that Barack Obama happens to be black, and that word is with inverted commas, has very little historical resonance and significance for his people. He's just another candidate. He may be slightly better than Hillary Clinton. He may be slightly worse. But in any case, nothing world historic is happening here for black people. And so, you know, what's the problem?
I think it's interesting, Glenn, that for a couple of things when you talk about the marginalized, you know, black theologian who's concerned about the, the role of the United States and American violence in the world. You know, it was a very unmarginalized black theologian who referred to the United States as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today.
Right.
Martin Luther King, 1967, breaking silence. And I think everybody, in order to get the right balance on this, it's complicated. In order to get the right balance on this, I think everybody should go back and read that 1967 speech of King's on breaking silence, about the relationship between the civil rights movement and the opposition to the war in Vietnam, and the concerns that King raised there about the role of the United States in the world and the way that the role of the United States in the world was destroying in many different levels, was destroying the possibilities for progress at home, destroying not just, and this was a very important point that King made, destroying it not just by taking the resources away, but by the kind of example that that American policy was setting for the very kids who were engaged themselves in destructive violence. Because that remark about the greatest purveyor, you know, it's quoted a lot, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, the point that when King makes that remark in the speech, he is explaining how hard it is for him to go into inner city neighborhoods where there's a growing, you know, violence on the streets and growing violence as an alternative to his own political strategy and say, hey, no, violence isn't the right way to do things.
Yeah.
And he says, but we got a problem, which is the United States, our country, is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. So it was that kind of, you know, the instruction that violence in the world provided for domestically that King was so concerned about. But I guess what I think is, I'm reminded of when you were at Stanford last year, it was about a year ago, and there was really what I thought was a great moment, and I'm being flattering, or something that you said that I thought was really terrific, and I think we've talked about this before. When Tommy Shelby was a wonderful person, a brilliant scholar and philosopher, and just an enormously decent, fine person, I think, made a kind of joking remark about your political trajectory, intellectual and political trajectory over the course of your career, and how, you know, your views had changed a lot. And I think it was a kind of a slip up moment, Tommy said, that, you know, your therapy wasn't done yet. And you got real mad about that. And I thought it was great that you were mad about it because you said, let's not be, basically, if there's a power, let's not be reductionist about this. This isn't about therapy. These are hard issues. And this is about trying to get some kind of understanding of them. And, you know, there are honest disagreements about them. And let's have the honest disagreements and talk about evidence and argument and not talk about this as if it were, you know, some kind of psychoanalytic exercise. Right. You know, I thought what was so bad about Obama in San Francisco was not what he said about bitter, but what he said about clinging. So when he talks about people clinging to their religion, it's as if he's saying they don't really believe this stuff. They're just so anxious about their it's that kind of psychological reductionism. And I think that's why I object to your talking about what Obama is doing as a brand. These are hard issues. You know that. Let's have humility about them. Try to argue them out as best we can and with due respect and understanding of our own limitations, severe limitations. And,
Okay, Josh, I mean, I got to give a lecture pretty soon. I want to say one more thing. And thank you for the comment, the laudatory comment. And also I hear what you're saying and I take your admonition seriously. The thing I want to say is this. So Barack Obama said in Philadelphia, I could no more divorce myself from my pastor than I could from the black community. I could no more disown him than I could my white grandmother, et cetera, in a famous line from that speech. Well, he's disowned Reverend Wright now, as everyone is reporting. But has he disowned the black community? Because that claim that he made in the Philadelphia speech actually has a certain ring of truth to it. I could no more disown my pastor than I could the community that he represents. It is, after all, an 8,000-member congregation. And Barack Obama was, after all, a member for over a decade, and all the things that we've said about what happened there. How do you disown? You know, everyone reports now on the front page, Obama, having said some words out loud, has severed his tie. How do you sever your tie to a church, a congregation, and a community? I'm talking about in reality, not in rhetoric. What happens when he goes back to Chicago? Does his family worship in that congregation anymore? What about the thousands of people who were congregants there with him who I would bet my life will line up behind Jeremiah Wright if asked to? There will be differences of opinion, differences of tonality, but the bottom line is going to be this is our pastor, this is our church, this is our movement, and this is our life. You can't disown Jeremiah Wright without disowning the community. So the question becomes, exactly what is Barack Obama's relationship to the community in light of the fact that he has disowned the pastor? And I'm wondering if reporters are going to go around with microphones now, like they did when this firestorm broke out, catching people on their way into the sanctuary at that church on the Sunday morning, and ask them, well, do you think your pastor was wrong or right? Because I think the answers to those questions are going to be preponderantly, my pastor is my pastor. In things of God, I follow my pastor.
I'm going to leave you the last word. I think that's a very important point, and I think it's
okay. Well,
it's very sad.
Thank you, Josh, for letting me get the last word this time. You know, I have to return the favor on the next occasion.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Josh.